This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Well, today we're going to have a remarkable edition of Dreamland. Why do I know that? I know that because Dr. Irina McCammon Scott is with us again. Dr. Scott is truly a remarkable interview, and for the reason is that she is one of the few actual experts on UFO secrecy and what it means and what it is about. And today she's going to be talking to us about its origins way back in the past, why it happened as it did, what mysterious organizations like the Battelle Memorial Institute really mean, a place where she has worked, and what their influence is, and it's huge. Then we're going to go into the threat assessment that has just been published. What does it mean? I don't think there's anyone in the field better equipped to talk about that than Dr. Scott. So let me give you a little bit of her background before I introduce her and welcome her to Dreamland. She received her PhD from the University of Missouri. She has been a professor at Bonaventure University. She's been at Ohio State University. She has worked at the Battelle Memorial Institute. She worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Aerospace Center in Satellite Photography. And she has a number of clearances. This is all correct, isn't it, Irina?
Yes, it is.
Well, welcome to Dreamland, I think I should say it. I'm very glad you have come. But among other things, Dr. Scott has actual face-to-face contact with things like some of the hidden parts of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. She knows about its Blue Room and a lot of other things. I think we're going to have a absolutely extraordinary interview. And you know where I would like to start, I think, is this question of how long this cover-up has actually been going on. Does it predate Roswell?
I have questions about that because we had some evidence that did. One was an interview I did with the daughters of Reverend Holt, who was a cousin of Cordell Hull, who was the Secretary of State and who Roosevelt wanted to run as his vice president, that about 1939, there, this is all verbal, there's no proof of it, that there, he had told his cousin that there were bodies and an object in the basements under the Capitol, and they were to keep quiet about it until many, many years after both of them died. And Bill Jones and I from Ohio were the first people to interview these daughters, and so we had, there's no proof of that or anything, but it was just interesting. And well, at that time, nobody knew there were chambers under the Capitol, which there are.
Tell us a little bit about those chambers. That's so odd.
They just said chambers, and at that time, nobody knew anything about chambers under the Capitol building. But I think now they know that because people have to hide underground pretty fast if there's an emergency.
Yes.
And so I think there are chambers, and I don't know how many or where they go to or anything else. They just said chambers under the Capitol building then, like it was the country's biggest top secret or something.
But there's supposedly something in those chambers, isn't there, or was?
They reported bodies, and I think they called them creatures. This was way before Roswell or anything, that weren't human, and I think they were in formaldehyde, I'm not sure, and an object that had sort of a brushed aluminum kind of surface.
I wonder where they are now. Maybe how ironic if they were still sitting there, just a few feet away from all of this cover-up and secrecy.
Well, I imagine they're long gone from there. But I have no idea. I think they've interviewed people, the same people later. But I don't know anything about where these would have gone. There's stories about all kinds of places where there might be bodies.
Now, the Wright-Patterson group, well, let's back up a little bit. There were basically two groups involved here after the Roswell incident and possibly before. Well, let me ask you a question just in parenthesis. Jacques Vallée and Paola Harris have recently published a book called Trinity, saying that, are presenting evidence that there was a UFO crash near the Trinity site in 1945, which would make sense in a certain way because there's been so much UFO activity connected in one way or another with atomic weapons. After all, the Roswell incident happened 30 miles from what was then the only operational atomic bomber wing in the world. So it could, the Trinity site possibility is there. Are you familiar with their book, and what do you think of that?
I just read about it. I don't have the book yet. So I can't say too much.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Now, tell us a little bit about once the Roswell incident kind of sunk in. General Exon told me that, and my listeners already know that I had, through my family, I had contact with him. He told me that everyone from Truman on now knew that what they'd found there was not of this world within 24 hours of our finding it. So what then began to unfold? At first, it looked like it was going to be the biggest news story in history. And then that all kind of imploded. What happened?
Well, I followed Kenneth Arnold more than I followed Roswell in a way, because he reported seeing the nine objects about a week before Roswell. And there was a number of things that happened to him that made me think that there's a cover-up already in place before him or Roswell. And he had a lot of very unusual things happen to him that didn't show up in UFO books or literature until way after that. And one of the things I noted was that he reported to Wright-Patterson real soon after he had his sightings, before Roswell.
He reported to Wright-Patterson? He went there?
He sent a message to Wright-Patterson.
Oh, I see. Yeah, which was then Wright Field, I guess.
Yeah, it was Wright Field. I'm sorry. And he said that this is a very important matter because strange aircraft have been seen over the Cascade Mountains, which he was the witness to. And he said they could, in combination with the atomic bomb, they could cause world destruction and everything else, and that another airline pilot, Captain Smith, had also seen him and observed the same type of thing. And he said this was a very important thing. Well, he reported it not too long ago, real soon after he had the sightings, and this was the main air base of the Air Force. It wasn't the Air Force then, but what became the Air Force, to report things to. And he heard nothing back. And he was amazed that these could be missiles from another country. He estimated their speed is going way beyond what we had. And he didn't hear anything back from Wright Field. And so he was pretty surprised. And then, he had a bunch of really unusual things happen to him. And then about a week later, Roswell happened. And he still didn't hear anything back. And he didn't know anything about Roswell because it was back then they just published it in the Roswell paper and maybe in Roswell. And that's about all anybody knew about it until 1980 when the book came out.
Right. Now, so he, and he did, they just never answered him. Is it because they had no protocol in place and nobody on the subject at Wright, or were they hiding something?
I don't know. I think somebody was hiding something because some of the material that he wrote about, he said, went to Washington, D.C. He didn't know where in Washington, D.C., but there apparently was an agency that was investigating UFOs back then. And go on. For example, one of the objects he saw looked like something that Mr. Rhodes had photographed in Arizona. And they told some military people told him that, but they said the original of the photographs had been sent to Washington, D.C. So it sounded like there was an agency in Washington, D.C. that was already active about UFOs. And I don't know about Wright-Patterson. It seemed to not be exactly coordinating with the Washington, D.C. group.
Well, if it was the Air Force on one end and another organization, especially if it was another military organization on the other, coordination would be a real issue. Free Dreamlanders, uh-huh. We're going to take a very brief break right now, and we'll be back in a moment with Dr. Irina McCammon-Scott. We're talking to Dr. Irina McCammon-Scott. Her website is irinascott.com. You can also find her on Facebook under the same name. We are discussing material from her book, Sacred Corridors, which you can get on her website along with all of her other books, and it is an incredible group of books. Dr. Scott's been on us on Dreamland with us a number of times. She's had Close Encounters of Her Own, which we have discussed before extensively. And if you're a subscriber, if you did become a subscriber, you would be able to listen to those shows. Very well worth it. Now, let's get back to this. I almost want to call it a sort of shadow presence within the government that seemed to be already in place controlling access and to this information. Do you have any idea of who it might have been? Because the CIA, for example, didn't even exist then. It was just being formed, I should say. For that matter, like the Air Force was still part of the Army when the Roswell incident happened. So who might it have been?
I don't know, but you said something was sent to the original photograph negatives were sent to Washington, D.C. And a number of things that happened to Arnold sounded like it was deliberately set up to make him look stupid or something. He was, at that time, nobody had heard of Roswell until 1980, and he was the first person that turned in what they considered a credible UFO report and started the whole idea of, you know, maybe their ET or something like that, or from a different world than ours.
Yeah, exactly. And they rushed to discredit him. And as far as the Roswell incident is concerned, it did briefly flash across news wires, but it was pulled back so quickly that it certainly never became much of an international story. It was very brief. And we were left with witnesses, and those witnesses were silenced. Now, there proceeded after that the emergence of something called Project Sign. Could you tell us a little bit about this? Was really the first response on the part of organized response on the part of the Air Force to this phenomenon. Could you tell us a little bit about Project Sign?
Well, Yes, the Air Force and the CIA came into existence right after the UFO reports. Project Sign started as UFO reports began to flood in around the time of Arnold. A lot of other people had seen similar things, so there were a lot of other witnesses. They took what would be considered to me, I mean, I have a copy of the document, a scientific stance. They considered the various things that could be, such as animals or different airplanes or things. They also considered spaceships and extraterrestrial civilizations and that sort of thing. And they tried to get detail on good observations and just in general studied the UFOs in a scientific way. And that didn't last for long. There was also a publication called Estimate of the Situation that concluded that based on the evidence that UFOs were alien aircraft, and this this document totally disappeared. That was before the internet or anything, and the copies of it just disappeared. And after that, that was the end, pretty soon was the end of Project Sign.
Now, General Hoyt Vandenberg comes into play here because he basically rejected the Air Force's conclusion in the Estimate of the Situation, which said that based on the evidence, UFOs were alien spacecraft, or to put it in terms of the time, interplanetary craft. Now, as you said, all traces of the report have disappeared. Now, and then General Vandenberg comes out saying that that's not the direction that we're going to go in. He said all Air Force policy will be that the interplanetary hypothesis is to be rejected. Now, there was quite a battle about this because it's obviously false and people knew it. Well, what was his motive?
I don't know. I never figured out. Maybe he was just, I don't know if he was part of a cover-up. I'm sure there was a cover-up. And maybe they selected him because he was totally against the idea that that UFOs could be something non-prosaic, or that, on the other hand, maybe he was part of the cover-up. I just didn't have enough information to figure it out, but I think there was a cover-up.
I'm wondering, by 1948, they would have known enough about these things to know two things. One, that they were not of this world. I mean, Exxon told me that they knew that almost immediately. And then they would also have known that they had extraordinary flight characteristics. And I understand that Nathan Twining believed, or rather feared, that they were some kind of demonic presence. And I'm just wondering if where Vandenberg's motive came from. Was it fear, perhaps, that this was something that the Air Force couldn't control? And in 1948, the Air Force's budget, it had just started, and the Truman administration, Truman Defense Department, was winding down expense war-related expenses as much as it could. And now this new organization, the Air Force, was needing a budget, and there was a possibility that the amount of money that had been allocated to the Army Air Force would be cut drastically. Could it be that if this had gotten out, that the Air Force was incapable of dealing with what appeared to be a threat, that that would have been a motivation for cutting it even more. I mean, I just can't figure it out. So strange.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I've tried to read about Vandenberg. I couldn't figure out. You know, biographies don't go into a lot of detail about him. I don't know. You know, I just couldn't figure out whether he was part of a cover-up or whether he was sincere. But he certainly had weight.
Well, he was so vehement about it. That's the thing. He was not. He was definitely making demands here. Project Grudge came about because of him. And tell us a little bit about the Sign was dissolved, its staff, which it included. So tell us a little bit about the Sign, Project Sign staff, and what their objectives were.
Well, the Project Sign seemed to have a pretty scientific viewpoint. I mean, they wanted to examine the real evidence and collect it and analyze it. But then when Project Grudge came, it was more like the idea of Vandenberg, that the ET was impossible, that all UFOs were prosaic, and like you said, under the control of the government. Nothing could possibly exist that wasn't under the control of the government. And so what they did was they replaced the staff of Sign, and a new project was formed, Project Grudge, which its name definitely described it, because it was more of a debunking thing. And various high-ranking Air Force officers, besides Vandenberg, disagreed with their conclusions of Sign. So they replaced all the people in Sign with people that were skeptical about UFOs and debunkers, which you wonder then if what went underground and what was above board. But the only thing that was open to the public was Project Grudge and then Project Blue Book.
Yeah, exactly. And Project Grudge shifts into Project Blue Book, which then their own data shows there is something there, but the conclusion, which is the only thing the media looked at, says the opposite. What was going on? I just can't figure it out. I'm thinking that, I keep coming down personally on the idea that the Air Force saw a threat that they could not do anything about, and that a threat from the air, which was potentially so dangerous, that it would maybe be the ultimate threat from the air. And here they were, helpless before it. And since it wasn't overt, but secret, they decided to hide it. Unless it goes even deeper, because I get back to that mysterious agency that you mentioned and that you're speculating about, basically, just as I am, what some people would call the deep state, I suppose. And it must be somewhere there. And in the third half hour, folks, we're going to be talking about the why of the appearance of this threat assessment that just showed up and what the classified parts of it may or may not contain and so on and so forth. But before we go down that road, I want to continue on a little bit. Were we shooting at these things at any point in this period, in 48, 49? Because there's some investigators have maintained that that did happen. Frank Ficino, in fact, wrote a whole book about it. So were we regarding this as a dangerous, hostile presence that we were attempting to resist?
Well, I think the first thing in everybody's mind right when it started was, are they going to take us over? You know, the conquering conquest idea of Europeans and things to take over anybody you can. And I think everybody's worried about that, military and everybody else. But I also think that the top of the government, the people there might have been afraid too, and not knowing exactly what to do. Maybe they were just superstitiously doing things that they thought would adjust things. I think that actually it might be, you know, they might take over by different means than physical machines, though. I mean, they might take over mentally, too. So I think it'd be a very complicated thing. But I think it'd be just as complicated mentally as their machines are physically. But, yeah, I think all along there was some top part of the government that knew something about it. And I don't know who was in it. I searched and there just wasn't any information that I could find. But I think there was somebody at the top of the U.S. government, maybe in the Pentagon or something.
Somewhere somebody knew something, and they were afraid. You mentioned ways of taking us over, and obviously an overt invasion has not happened. But something has happened. Something has definitely happened, because they are in the minds of many people. I know you've had, you mentioned in the last time you were on Dreamland, we talked about your own UFO encounters, and I thought maybe it would be interesting to just go through that again together for a few moments. But first, Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be back with Dr. Irina McCammon Scott. We're talking to Dr. Irina McCammon Scott. Her website is irinascott.com. You can get all of her books there, and they are really wonderful, really well-researched, deep journeys into areas that other researchers cannot go. And in a little while, we're going to be talking about the amazing story of the Battelle Memorial Institute. And then later in the show, we're going to go deep into the threat assessment, what it means, why it happened now, and where it may lead. Now, I'm also going to ask Dr. Scott if she can speculate at all about the classified part of it. Given her knowledge, that may prove to be true. But right now, Irina, I would like you to just run through your own experience, your own encounter experiences, as you have talked about before on the show. But many people, as always, the show is always growing, and so many people are listening to it for the first time. Tell us a little bit about the book that you wrote that concerned your experiences that we talked about on Dreamland in 2019.
Okay, my book was called Inside the Lightning Ball, and this was about my own and the experiences of a number of scientists, because they always say scientists don't believe in UFOs, only idiots do and all that. Well, a lot of scientists have reported and investigated. With my own experience, it started when I was very young, and it follows something that was published much later by Jenny Randles called Star Children. It's about the trend that often people that see UFOs as adults have had earlier experience when they were kids with UFOs, like small UFOs in their bedroom and things like that. And then later they grow up and they see a UFO. Well, my sister and I had maybe the only people in the world that had the experience together of seeing UFOs when we were kids and also as adults. And this happened, it's something my whole family remembered. We were real poor, and my sister and I were sleeping in opposite sides of an attic room. It was night, and the room was had two doors that were closed and a window that was closed. It was a clear night. And I know that for other reasons, but she was probably about four and I was about six. We'd never heard of UFOs or spacemen or anything like that. I woke up and this thing was flying around inside our dark room. It was, it might be the original tic-tac shaped object. You know, I think I first described it as a cough drop shape. It was glowing and it looked like hot metal or hot iron. And it was just taking a browsing motion of flying around our room and it got real close to both of us several times. And it just seemed to be browsing around. Well, at that age, I noticed that this isn't anything normal because the lights were off, but it seemed to know where everything was. And if it approached the wall, it turned. If it approached furniture, it turned. It didn't run into anything. Then after it browsed for a while, it flew up to the ceiling, and it turned before it got to the ceiling. And it was an attic room with the walls that came together at the ceiling about 3 feet apart. In the middle of the room was a chandelier. It just flew over the chandelier. It didn't feel its way around or anything. It seemed to know where the chandelier was and where the walls were, and it began to circle the chandelier. And then it just made a perfect geometrical spiral down. It seemed to be going a lot faster when it kind of circled the chandelier. Well, at that point, I didn't know my sister was awake. She apparently knew I was awake. But we both just shrieked. We were just absolutely terrified. We tried to run out of the room and fell down the stairs and then ran to our parents who didn't believe us. But everybody in the family remembered it. And what was odd about it was is that there's no, I have no idea how it got in the room, but we both seemed to wake up about the same time when it was in there. And then we both became terrified at the same time. And in thinking about it later, it's sort of like there was some mind control or something like that going on. And they always say when they, all these reports on UFOs say, there's no threat to national security. Well, they don't actually say there's no UFOs. They just say there's no threat to national security. Well, thought control is a threat to national security.
I should say.
I think there was thought control there, some type of thought control or mind control. Because, you know, there was somebody else, and we both responded the same way, and we weren't in communication at the time. And also, it was interesting that the room was closed off, but the thing was in there anyway. Then later, a number of years later, I was working for the Defense Intelligence Agency. I had a very high clearance. This was the sensitive compartmented information type clearances, which is the highest in the government. I was working in satellite photography. It was in air order of battle. And I was to the section I was in identified aircraft over a certain area of the world by satellite photography. My sister was at Drew University taking graduate courses, and we were both on the East Coast, so we decided to go up and take a vacation and see the New England states. And I was in the closet about UFOs, and so neither of us ever mentioned it or anything else. But we were going to stop at Boston and then go up the next day. But we couldn't find a motel room in Boston. We were leaving Boston. And as we were leaving, there was an airport south of Boston. I think it's called Norwood Memorial Airport. And we could see airplanes coming in, landing, and flying around. And they would turn their landing lights on, and you could see the landing lights and the wing lights, red and green and everything. But as we were leaving, there was another object lower than the airplanes, which was, it just looked like an object. It was blinking off and on. It was real, real white. Didn't look anything like an airplane. So we got an argument about it, and my sister kept saying, this is something odd, it's a UFO, and I kept saying no. But she was watching it, and I was driving. and we argued about it. As we went, she said it would just be in one place and then it'd be someplace else. And then it'd be someplace else. And it didn't seem to necessarily travel from one place to another. And I wasn't watching. I thought she'd just flipped. And so later, we went on Route 9. And there was this object near the ground that it looked like a glass thing. And it seemed to hold a light that was going through a spectrum of red and blue and then red, all shades of red and all shades of blue. And at that time, the inside of our car lit up in green. And I had no idea what was going on. I looked at the light. It wasn't green. I couldn't see green any place except in our car. And I just had no idea what it was or what was going on. So I kept on going. Then my sister kept yelling at me to stop because the thing that we'd been watching was going to go over the road. And so I stopped. And I was just about to point it out to her and say, that's a helicopter, dingbat. And I saw what looked like a meteor way off in the distance. And then right there where I saw it, this thing came over the road. It had seven big windows. They were blinking in a sequence. There was like the first three would blink on and off, then all seven would blink on and off, and then the last four would blink on and off. I'm not too sure if that was a pattern, but something like that. These were big things that looked like windows, and we discussed, are these panels or windows? And we'd both seen blimps with lighted sides, and we thought we were looking in windows. It had a small red unblinking light on one end and a green light on the other. And it was very close. We could see it real close. At that time, I had a Polaroid camera in my car and a high-speed Polaroid film in my trunk, and I got them out real fast. And I was trained in photography because I was working for the DIA. I thought I could just get a wonderful picture because if I could get that over a couple of pictures of that so that you could see it maybe in stereo. And maybe enhance it and get the background and stuff. Well, I could just take a spectacular picture. And so I was loading up my camera, which took a while. And I was just ready to take a picture. And a truck driver pulled over in front of us. And the man came. And he had just driven by this thing that was over the road. And he asked me, What are you doing? And I pointed at the thing, and I didn't say UFO or anything like that to a strange man. But what he did, he just rotated around, looked in the exact opposite direction of where it was, said, I don't see anything. Then he looked back at me, and I was pretty nervous at that time even. I was nervous because he was a man, too. But then he asked the same thing, what are you looking at? And I pointed again and acted like it was an airplane. And he rotated around, looked in the exact opposite direction, rotated back, and said, I don't see anything. And then he gave me, like, the crazy sign. I don't know exactly. I just interpreted that way. He pointed to his head and went back to his truck. Well, at that time, my sister and I sort of had an argument because I wanted to run up a hill and try to get good pictures of it. And I was afraid if I was on the freeway, I'd get lens flares from car license. My sister tried to prevent me, and I kept trying to tell her she had to guard the car from the man, and she didn't seem to know what I was talking about. But anyway, I finally ran up the hill, and I got pictures, which I published in a scientific journal later. But then I came back, and the thing went over to the airport and began to circle from the south to north. It would blink on twice as it went south to north. You get north, and it would go south in half a circle so fast you couldn't even see it. Well, I decided I'd turn the car around to the next intersection and go back because I thought it might go north. We were a little bit south of it. And so I got on the freeway. Well, this man that was in the truck began to chase us in a threatening manner. I mean, if I slowed down, he slowed down. If I speeded up, he speeded up. And I had no idea what to do because he had his bright lights. He was right behind me, right on my bumper, and shining his bright lights in my mirror. And I was blinded driving. And I thought, we're going to get killed. And I couldn't get rid of him. I would change lanes and everything else. He just stayed right there. So finally, I decided what to do would be to get off the freeway at an intersection, but go up in the left-hand lane and suddenly swerve. And this was real dangerous because somebody was coming up behind us. We'd get killed and all that. But anyway, I did and got off the freeway and came back. The thing was still circling. We just then started going northwest, and I followed it. I followed it past the thing on the woods, and the inside of the car lit up in green. And then we finally followed it a long ways, and we wound up in this real horrible gravel road with bumps and everything, houses miles apart from each other where you couldn't turn around. And I couldn't keep up with it, and I wasn't going to get a picture, so I just turned around, and we went back. And later, we went back to all the way back to New York and called our parents. And I'd picked up some people from the DIA, and for some reason they didn't get in contact with me. Finally, I went home to Washington and had a poltergeist experience later that night. But what was a threat to national security was I had this high security clearance. And like if he was, the truck driver fought us in a threatening manner, if I'd have been killed, well, that would have affected national security because of my job. But even if I were injured, it would affect national security because with that clearance, if I was in a hospital, I was supposed to have an FBI person there if I were unconscious or something. And so, you know, it's they always say there's no threat to national security. Why? Because there was a threat to national security from the UFO phenomenon.
Well, I think that qualifies as a threat to national security. That's the best and clearest explanation of why that it might be perceived as a threat that I've ever heard. Now, let's get back to this truck driver. This is a ultra high strangeness situation here because he wasn't just an ordinary truck driver. Something else was going on. It had to have been. But Irina, before we go on, Free Dreamlanders, it's time for your break. Enjoy this. We're talking to Dr. Irina McCammon Scott about many things, including her own stunner UFO experiences. You can reach Dr. Scott at irinascott.com. You can find her on Facebook. All of her books, including the ones that she's talking about right now, are available on her website. Don't miss Dr. Scott's work. It is unique in this world, very obviously, from what you're hearing here. Very, very obviously. And subscribers, you can listen to more Dr. Irina Scott's work and interviews here on Dreamland by simply clicking on the link on the show page and go back and explore our many encounters with Dr. Scott, which have all been just as extraordinary as this one. Okay, the truck driver. If we're talking about control and mind control and levels of control, where in the world did he come from?
Well, I found out more about him just very recently than I had before because my sister, about 2 months ago, found a letter that she had written to my mother that same day when we got back to Drew. And I had always wondered, the truck driver seemed so weird. And when I ran to take the pictures, my sister didn't seem to understand that she had to protect the car from the truck driver. And I might have never asked her before, but I asked her if she knew the truck driver was there, and she said no. And she was standing right beside me, and I didn't realize that ever until 2 months ago. But and then she did know that she did remember him chasing us and everything. But when he was there talking, she apparently didn't know he was there, and he was standing right beside us. And that seemed pretty weird, especially considering that he's pointing his head like I was crazy. And I just wondered if there might have been some mind control there where I saw him and she didn't, but maybe she was just concentrating real hard on trying to see what was in the UFO too, or whatever it was. So the whole thing, I mean, it was like he was telling me I was crazy, and like maybe my sister didn't even see him.
So what was really going on? Could he have been something somehow put into your mind by whatever was, I have to say, menacing you?
I don't know, because another reason I figured out, I kind of knew, you know, because he appeared as we were having a close encounter that he had something to do with UFO. But just not too long ago, I was trying to figure out why I knew he had something, that he probably had something to do with the UFO. And another thing was, is that when you point at something and somebody can't see, they look in the direction you point. Well, he did just the opposite. When I pointed, he turned around and looked, you know, just exactly 180 degrees opposite in the same azimuth as the object, just exactly the opposite of it. He did that twice. And that's not what a human or even an animal does if you point at something.
No.
And so for that reason, I also thought that maybe this was not a real truck driver.
Yeah. Now, so, you know, I've talked to many people in, not exactly in the same situation you're in, but people with clearances. And many of them have had bizarre encounters. Not very few of them have ever talked about this on Dreamland, just one or two, you being one of them. But it's common in the field. And in fact, on the military end of it, as I've said on this site before or show before, a lot of families of military people who are exposed to this have extraordinary experiences. And we just had a show on a few weeks ago with Matthew Roberts, who was on the Roosevelt during the Gimbel incident in 2000, I believe in 17. I could be wrong about the date, folks. Excuse me if I am. And he then became engaged with this on a very deep way. So there is a level of control here, definitely. Now, but is it hostile? If we have any way of telling whether or not it's hostile, what is your sense of that?
They say, you know, nothing's physically taken us over, so we don't have to worry. But I don't know if there's mind control, whether you would even know if you were taking over, because I don't know. UFOs may be something totally, totally different from us. And we might not even know it if there's mind control. And also, maybe the reason the government is so, it seems so illogical about not admitting that there's evidence that, I mean, didn't admit it until last week. Maybe there's some kind of control there too.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that more in the third half hour, but right now I want to go to something that's little known publicly, but known, very well known among people like us who are doing deep research into this. And certainly you are. And that's the Battelle Memorial Institute. Can you tell us what it is and what your relationship or association with it was?
It's a research organization, independent research organization that does research for, it has a lot of government contracts and other sponsors. It's maybe most notable as important in the development of Xeroxy or copying, but it's had a lot to do with a number of things, and it's over Oak Ridge and a number of national laboratories like that. So it's, most people haven't heard of it, but it's a really big organization. that does independent research for different contractors.
Now, you have in Sacred Corridors a lot of discussion about nitinol, and where I want to start is with the really the shovel full of debris and dirt that was taken, I guess, first to Wright Pat. Is that correct, or to Wright Field? Am I right about that? And ended up with Battelle.
It was, they always say that Roswell's fictional, nothing happened. Well, there's real definite proof that it was sent to Wright-Patterson because there was a radio announcer at Roswell at that time when the flight was taking the debris from Roswell to Wright-Patterson. And he, right in the middle of his broadcast, He said that the flight is en route to Wright-Patterson and that he had just called Wright-Patterson and hadn't arrived yet. So that's very hard proof that something was sent to Wright-Patterson.
And that has been buried in most of the research, the fact that that even happened.
There's very hard proof that that's not a myth, that something was sent. It was sent in a B-29, and there might have been another aircraft carrier later. The story was is that it was especially the B-29 is a bomber.
Right.
And in order to send the material, they had to make special crates that fit inside the bomb bay to carry it to. It first of all went to Fort Worth Airport and then to Wright-Patterson.
Well, why would they use a bomber when they had cargo transports readily available?
Well, I think later they sent it by cargo, and maybe there just wasn't any available right then or something. I don't know.
Oh, I see.
But
unless they were guarding it and were afraid it might be attacked, because the bomber would.
I don't know.
The bomber has, of course, defensive capabilities.
Yeah, I don't know. Once I was at Wright-Patterson, talking with the. Actually, I was in the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson at the time, talking to the archivist. And somebody went by and said that his father had piloted the plane from Roswell to Wright-Patterson. And I didn't know why the archivist didn't get that information and interview him. The archivist said, oh, everybody knows that. That's boring. But that seemed like pretty interesting. Useful information. I think people have interviewed him, though.
Well, tell us about the Blue Room. We've got so much going here. Tell us a little bit about the Blue Room.
Well, the Blue Room is supposed to be this area where they have, it's famous because, let me see what his name, Goldwater asked Curtis LeMay, Goldwater was interested in the UFOs, and he asked Curtis LeMay about the Blue Room. And Curtis LeMay told him to shut up and never say anything about it again. And other people have asked, and Leonard Stringfield said this was a place where they had bodies and debris and all that. And so, I had heard of the Blue Room, and I had heard of, you know, how secret it was. Well, I had been on Wright-Patterson base before. The company I worked for had sent me to Wright-Patterson for conferences and things. And I had just wandered around because it was in the secured area, and nobody told me not to, so I wandered around, took pictures. And inside the secured area, there's chain-link fences and guards all over the place and everything else, so you can't really get in. But on account of the conference and things, I was in for different reasons several times. But I noticed this one building that was different from all the other buildings because even though it was in a secured area, it had all the security around it. They had monitoring video things on the roof and all kinds of these funny monitors around the periphery and everything else. And it was totally different from all the other buildings. And later, the archivist took me and another person in there to a meeting on UFOs. And I was totally impressed by the security. And later, Carrie and Donald Smith wrote a book, I think it was called Area 51 of Wright Patterson or something, and said that Anthony Bragola had asked on an FOIA document, where's the blue room? And they'd said, this is the NASIC building. Well, that was the NASIC building that we were in. And I didn't realize it was the blue room until years later after I'd been in there, but it was pretty interesting that I'd been in there.
Yeah, you had no idea of where you actually were in terms of its level of secrecy. It's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. Absolutely fascinating. Okay, let's just briefly go back to Battelle and Nitinol, because that material is real, and it was developed, I think, and I believe you can back me up on this, out of analysis of materials that were found either at Roswell or at Roswell and or other sites. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is?
It's nitinol. It's one of some of its composition is titanium and nickel. And this material that they've made is nitinol, is like memory metal. It returns to its shape. And that was a characteristic of that was reported to be of the of some of the Roswell material that would return to its shape and you couldn't destroy it or anything.
Yeah, my uncle told me all about the experience of analyzing that, and it's exactly right.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was at Wright Field when in the Air Materiel Command when the materials were brought. And so was General Exon, for that matter. And General Exon had a lot more to say privately than he ever said to any UFO investigators, including Stanton Friedman. Unfortunately, you're asked to keep things under your hat, and you can't. You know, it's a road I can't go too far down, but I can go far enough down that road to say that that memory metal was real. And so they developed it out of now. You know, they must have been studying things like the propulsion methodologies intensely over the past few years, past 60 or 70 years, because this would be the way these things move would be the absolute holy grail of all technological research into this field. And we're going to end the first part of Dreamland now, Free Dreamlanders. But subscribers, we'll just keep straight on keeping on. For subscribers, we're going to get into this whole issue of what we do know, what might be in the classified part of the report, and above all, why now? And I think it's going to be a very interesting discussion. Irina McCammon Scott's website is irinascott.com. You can get all of her books there, and there is not one of them that isn't absolutely essential reading for anyone who takes a serious interest in this subject. And if you don't take a serious interest in this subject at this point, you're not living on planet Earth. You're living somewhere else without knowing it. Okay, Irina, I would like to thank you so much, as always, for being with us on Dreamland. And subscribers, just keep on. We're going to go right on without a break. Free Dreamlanders, thank you very much for being with us. Irina, is the threat assessment's public release, the admission that there is something unknown here, a sea change in this whole thing, or is it part of a longer process?
I hope it's a part of a longer process, but it certainly seemed like a big change to me because previously they've said that no such thing as a non-prosaic object exists, that everything can be explained. And everything they've published has said that. Finally, they admitted that maybe there's something that they don't understand that's flying around. I think this was the first time they ever did, except for Project Sign way, way back.
Yeah, which was essentially repudiated. Project Sign was, the scientists in Project Sign were all fired, and the Project Grudge people weren't interested in science. They were just interested in lying, basically, about this. Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that the genesis of the threat assessment appears to have been really Leslie Keene and Ralph Blumenthal's first story in the New York Times, which initiated the whole thing, because they got a hold of the Tic Tac video, and they managed to reach a sufficiently high level of credibility to justify the story being published in the New York Times. And that's changed everything. Now, I know Leslie and Ralph very well. They're both good friends. And whatever they got, the decision to give it to them in the first place was made behind them. In other words, they ended up with it not because of because somebody decided to send it to them. And they know who. I mean, it's not a secret. And Lou Elizondo has been heavily involved. But what is the motive, do you think, behind someone like Lou Elizondo, who will not, by the way, interview on this radio program, to my great surprise? And yet, at the same time, it's a little scary because I know that a lot of the insiders think I'm sort of involved with the visitors. In other words, that I'm on their side, and they do take sides. Which, of course, I'm not on there. I'm not on anybody's side. I'm on the side of trying to figure out what's going on. That's the side I'm on. Anyway, do you have any sense of what might have motivated someone in possession of a lot of secret information and videos and so forth to suddenly do something so completely unexpected?
Well, I think for one thing, some of the jet pilots were coming out in the open. And the people in Nimitz were. And I think, for another thing, the Air Force has always hidden everything. Maybe that's because UFOs are a threat to them, because they're the Air Force and they're supposed to control the air. Well, I think since way back, the Navy has been a little more open than the Air Force about UFOs. And the Nimitz and the Princeton and everything were Navy experiences. And possibly, just because it was a different government agency, and the Navy has been a little bit more open, maybe that had something to do with it.
So far, no Air Force comment, no Air Force release of anything has happened since the threat assessment was published. They've been totally silent. Is that because they're facing the fact somehow that they've been lying for 70 plus years, and now everybody knows it?
Well, maybe not 70 years, maybe 73 years, because it seemed like Project Sign was a little bit honest, but after that, it seems like they've been lying through their teeth for quite a few years. And maybe, you know, they don't want to just say, well, we've lied to you for all those years. But they do have an opening now because they have different equipment, different radar equipment, and maybe they can say, well, this is due to our different equipment that we can study things differently and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So maybe they have a bit more of an opening.
Well, you know, my contact with the visitors is, it's not very physical. I have to admit that. But it is pretty extensive in that I've learned how to communicate with them fairly easily. And years ago, they said that they would emerge if we lost control of the planetary environment and that the planet was going to basically shake us off. And when I see that this disclosure level is happening at the same time that this appalling heat wave is sweeping across the whole Arctic. And it's not just, we hear about the part of it in the Americas. What we don't hear is about the high Arctic and Siberia, where the heat wave is absolutely shocking as well. And this is a very, very serious sign that a fundamental shift of climate is about to take place. And that shift of climate is not going to leave an Earth that is as easily used at any level, including agriculture and all kinds of different things, as is true now. And so maybe their emergence is indeed happening because of what's happening to the Earth. I don't know.
What? I think their emergence has to do with them, too. I don't think we could, you know, if the government came out and said UFOs exist and all that, well, we wouldn't be able to prove it without them. And so I think, you know, they probably have something to do with the release of the information in a way.
Yeah, I would think so, because, you know, when we were talking earlier about mind control, I've always felt that they were actually in more or less complete control of what was happening, involving them especially. In other words, they are calling the shots, even though we don't know it. And they, well, for example, they don't even need to, it doesn't even need to be something mysterious in terms of some kind of internal control of the human mind, although that may be part of it. But when you look at what happened at Roswell and at the Trinity site, both times these UFO crashes occurred in extremely sensitive areas. The Roswell site was crash sites 30 miles from the most sensitive military base in the world, the only atomic bomber wing on Earth. And that would have sent, boy, you talk about sending up danger signals to the Air Force. That an unknown object crashes that close to that base, boy, would they be concerned about it. And they would also certainly put a lid on it and keep it secret, even before they knew what exactly was happening. And that's exactly what happened. And maybe the visitors would have known that. Maybe they, in other words, maybe they engineered the secrecy simply by threatening us in a way that we would want to keep secret.
Well, I was worried about that, and I mentioned it in the book, maybe the top of the government's afraid of them, but you don't know really who's at the top of the government. I mean, it might be aliens, too, and I think that's a possibility that ought to be considered, that maybe real high in the government, there's an alien influence, or whatever they are.
If there is more than one group here, or more than one set of motives, it could be that there are aliens who are trying to contact us, and aliens who are trying to prevent that. And that would explain why these are not landings, but crashes. I wonder, what do you think about that? I mean, we're just speculating. We're dancing on a limb here, the two of us, but that's what we do on Dreamland, right? What do you think of that possibility?
I wrote a article in MUFON Journal years ago with a French ufologist, Jean Sider, and what we wrote was is that if they're indestructible. They have indestructible materials. Why would they crash?
Yeah.
And what we were saying was maybe that's a display.
Well, some of the people who have been gathering materials for years call one of the sites the donation site, according to Diana Pasulka in her book American Cosmic, and she knew one of the people who was involved in that quite well, apparently. So yeah, that would be a reason. But, you know, there were bodies at Roswell. I know that because General Exon talked about them privately. My uncle did not, but General Exon was very plain spoken about it. He even described them, but then proceeded to say, "You're not to ever tell anyone anything about what I said." And I'm very concerned about that now. I don't know what to say because it's something we'll deal with folks on the air down the road for sure. But in any case, my concern here is that there could be a conflict inside the whole alien spectrum, and all of the secrecy and the obfuscation and the confusion on our level could have to do with that conflict about what to do with us.
It's very, very, very complex. And with mind control, it's just, I mean, actually, our experiments in quantum mechanics are so weird that they seem weirder than ufology to start with. They make your whole idea of reality questionable. And so it's just very hard to say even what reality is to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, we have, you know, there are a number of books out about that very issue of what quantum physics is telling us about our ability to even know what is real. And we may not actually have that ability. We have the ability to see what appears to be real to us, but that may not be what's actually here.
Well, some of their results, like the entangled particle thing, where apparently, according to the beginning experiments, a particle on one end of the universe knows instantaneously what its paired particle on the other end of the universe does. That basically, we don't understand anything about time or space, and those are real preliminary experiments.
Yeah, very much so. And we have, I wonder if there are people who directly interface with aliens within the United States government. What is your sense of that?
Well, I think there's a lot of secrecy because, my work at the DIA, we were to identify aircraft over a particular area. My supervisors were top people in our particular area. They were authorities. And after I had the UFO experience, it was while I was working for the DIA. And, of course, I didn't go and say I saw a UFO because, you know, everybody say you're crazy and you lose your job. But I just mentioned the subject of UFOs. And my supervisor said that they had found, they had reported a UFO on our satellite photography, which is real classified, and that their supervisors had said it was a spot on the film. Well, it wasn't. And there were a lot of reasons why, but it made me think somebody way up there that had clearances above my supervisors was doing the same thing that they did to Kenneth Arnold when he reported UFOs, that somebody saying, "Oh no, you didn't see that. That didn't happen."
Yeah.
People that report them.
Well, now there's a classified level of the report, and I've heard that there are 45 minutes of extraordinary video in that classified level of the report, and some congressmen were really shocked by what they saw. I've also heard, I believe this comes from Richard Dolan, that there may be material in it about the propulsion systems. And now I've been up close and personal with these propulsion systems, but I can't tell you how they work. I only know that they certainly do work. Obviously, they work. We all know that. But do you have any sense of what, from your, not, I know you haven't read the classified report, but from all of your knowledge of the way this stuff kind of works and your inside information, do you have any sense of what this classified report may contain?
Well, I would say that from my work in the DIA, I would guess that they have real good videos of UFOs from up above in the satellite photography that nobody's publishing. I mean, they're very, very careful about anything with satellite photography. But they make a study of all the aircraft all over the world and all the air bases and everything else, military bases. So I would guess they have good videos of UFOs from up above. But what's funny about UFOs is they may be something totally different from anything we can imagine. I mean, we're thinking of crafts with pilots and stuff, and it may be something different from that. They may be different material or something just totally different that we just don't understand at all. So I don't know.
No, I think you speak with authority, because given what happened to you in your bedroom as a child, I mean, that was not a craft with a little pilot in it. It'd be less than the size of an ant. And, you know, it obviously was something else. But, you know, Irina, I waited. We're coming toward the end of the show. And I this is a question I've asked myself a thousand times about my own life. And I've asked others about their lives. And people have asked me, and I've thought about it. Why you?
Why you?
I knew you were going to say that. Well, you know, there's something very strange about the, you know, the certain people are definitely being chosen to confront this mystery. That would be the best way to put it.
And I have no idea why. I think something happens to you that you're a lot more open-minded, because I think if nothing happened to me, I would be a debunker until now. But it seemed like there was something way, way back in my life when I was just practically a baby. I used to dream about round things in the sky, and I'd wake up just screaming and so horrified I couldn't believe it. And that was even before the other thing happened. And it was like something, you know, it influenced me from practically the time I was a baby. And I wonder about that, too, if some people get influenced kind of early in their life.
Well, it certainly I did. Same thing from very early age. And many, many other people, and they often discover later, you knew this all of your life. I had forgotten about it completely, speaking of mind control. It must have been swept from my mind somehow, because by the time I was in the 70s, when I was in my 20s and early 30s, when this subject was brought up, I was very adamantly opposed to even discussing it. Yet I had had extensive experiences when I was a child. So, you know, here we are in this situation. Did you ever in your journeys through the classified world hit on anything about propulsion systems that you can talk about?
Well, you read all kinds of things. No, I didn't. But I wonder about propulsion. They seem to levitate. And I wonder if they're just some kind of material or made or composed of something that's just a lot different from us, so that they can levitate through our world and go through the walls and everything else that just isn't like us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've read about Lazar and everybody, and I've seen, you know, mock-ups of where they try to imitate a UFO and that sort of thing. But I wonder if it's really propulsion, or if there's something just different that they don't interact the same way we do.
That they don't interact with the physical world in the same way that we do. That, I think, might be the answer to this question. But, you know, at the same time, there was a period of time in our life when we had our old cabin that we would we would hear this device coming over the roof and then landing in the front yard. We would hear, but not see. It couldn't be seen. But when it came over the roof, what you would hear was what sounded like something that had been rotating very fast and was slowing down and had ball bearings in it that weren't so tightly touching each other that they would kind of click together as it went over the roof of the house with startling speed and accuracy. You'd think that the sound passed over the house so quickly and then ended up in the front yard. You would think that it would have crashed in the front yard. It would have made a hole because it would not slow down. It would just go from speed to stopped in an instant. And then, of course, I would go rushing out in the front yard and say, "Where are you? I know you're here. Why don't you show yourself?" And then one time I went back into the house and I was up in the bedroom with Ann, and I said, "You know, it's there. I know it's there." And we proceed to hear footsteps walking down the front porch. I rush down again and can't see a thing. It was like they were playing with me.
Well, I experienced the same thing with the poltergeist thing after we had that.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, I was in my bedroom going to sleep that night, and I heard somebody walking in my bedroom. It was just like a man walking with shoes on, and like take three steps and stop and then start someplace else. Well, I couldn't figure out. I tried to move and catch it, and there was a little bit of light from the street, but I couldn't see anybody. And then my alarm went off, and I thought it was morning and got up and realized it was late at night. And the alarm went off at like 1:30, and I had an alarm clock. It was real hard to set because the nub had broken off, and I sort of had to use tweezers to set it, and I couldn't set it accurately at all with my fingers. But for some reason, I was terrified, and I went back to sleep, and the alarm went off again. It was 2:30. I was really terrified, and I got up and put a chair against the door. I mean, I don't know what good that did if something was in the room with me. But then I, although I was terrified, I went back to sleep. And at 3:30, 4:30, and 5:30, the alarm went off each time, and right on time. And I couldn't understand how it got set or what was going on. And then I was sitting there, and I'd never heard of poltergeist, and I thought I'd just gone insane. And I was sitting on my bed wondering what I was going to do at work if I was insane because I'd lose my security clearance and everything. And then my toothbrush just flew across the room and hit the wall. Oh. And then it was all but I was pretty worried.
Yeah, I can imagine. There's nothing. I mean, you're being a woman and having a strange man in your bedroom in the middle of the night is one thing, but when you can't see him, that's really very concerning. Must have been very concerning, yeah, of course. Well, you know,
because
that's
a pretty loose job.
But isn't this a wonderful example of why when we think about aliens in little spaceships flying around, that's not the whole story by any means.
I think it's a lot more complex than that.
Yeah.
Aliens, a spaceship is like us, and these may be a whole lot different.
Can you give us a sort of an idea of how your thinking works in this area?
Well, I was thinking that what we're thinking of as alien spaceship is about 1500s Newtonian physics, and now we have quantum physics, and it's a whole lot different. And something that affects you mentally, apparently, too. And so, you know, I think maybe people need to understand physics and how the brain works and things like that a lot better.
I think that the interface between the brain and consciousness is probably the whole key to this, because the brain filters something. It does not generate it. And if we understood how that filtration system works, we might also understand more about what's really there. That's my impression.
That's my impression, too. I mean, like, we have the quantum theory, and we only detect certain levels of energy. Well, there may be zillions of other energies that we don't detect that aren't on our quantum level. And so it's just like looking, trying to see through Venetian blinds or something. We're just missing a whole lot of what's going on.
Right. I think we are, and I think that maybe this whole thing is really challenging us, because what we're looking at here is probably going to turn out to be the most stressful time in human history since the end of the Ice Age, and that is that we are seeing a rapid and detrimental change in the planetary environment that's going to make it very hard for us to continue on as we are now. I mean, I'm not saying we're not going to continue on at all, but as we are now, I don't think so. At the same time, we are face to face with this extraordinary mystery, not only the mystery of that it poses to the mind and to our understanding of reality, but also the physical mystery. I mean, I've got some of the materials right here in this office. And, you know, I've had them for a long time. They were given to me by Art Bell. And I know that they're the real deal because they've been, that mine have never, have only been studied once at Southwest Research, and then not formally studied, but well studied, because, you know, the Dr. William Mallow had access to all of the equipment that the Institute had to offer, and it was extensive. But some of the material was actually taken from me at Southwest, or I should say I loaned it to what turned out to be a Navy laboratory. I met the officers who were involved. We had lunch together and everything, and it was very sweet, only they never sent it back. So, and some of the
material... Never loaned anything to the government.
Some of that same material that was analyzed elsewhere, I believe, by Dr. Vallée and Dr. Gary Nolan, and it was found to have isotopic ratios that not only are not of Earth, but also not of this universe. And I think that's how the analysis was done. In any case, I know there was something very strange about it, because I used to keep it in a manila envelope, and I noticed at one point that there was a scorch mark inside the manila envelope that had appeared over a period of years. And then now it's gone. The Navy's involved in this. The Navy's doing. I wonder if it isn't maybe that the Air Force has shot at them and has a hostile relationship to them, and the Navy never has and therefore doesn't have a hostile relationship. Could it be that's why the Navy's willing to reveal its materials and the Air Force isn't?
Yeah, that could be. I had some information about Shield Alloy that I wrote about in my book, that they had analyzed some substance, and I also had some information on the substance, but I don't know if the person that remembers, you know, it real accurately. It was like crystalline. It was
crystalline.
Silicon crystalline. Magnesium, cobalt, chromium, aluminum, steel, nickel, vanadium, and titanium, but like an alloy. But it could be, I don't know.
And, of course, nitinol is an alloy of a couple of those metals.
Uh-huh.
So.
I didn't get this through UFO sources. I got it through another source, but they said that it seemed like that maybe Wright-Patterson was shipping out samples to different companies to have metals analyzed around that time, around 1952. That's why we reported on Elroy John Center, that he said that he was analyzing material from a UFO crash, and Shield Alloy, they had a shovel full of material, and they told him it might be a meteor or a crash, or it might have been a crash in New Mexico, and they were to analyze it too. And it seemed like a number of places in Ohio around that time received metal that they wanted to analyze.
And they did analyze them, and you know, that's 1952. You can better you better be sure they've been analyzing them ever since. I mean, they have worked over every single scrap of this 1,000 different ways, I'm sure.
Yeah. And it was like they were sort of just sending them out to people to analyze. I mean, we wrote about that way back in the 1994 about something that happened in about 1952 about John Center, who said he was studying parts retrieved from a UFO, and he was working for Battelle. And back then in 1952, people didn't know anything about Roswell.
He may not have known where the materials were even from.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But this person, Battelle, did say that he was studying parts retrieved from the flying saucer.
So here we are now. It's 2021, not 1952. And this stuff has all been held secret all this time. I wonder if the floodgates are going to open or close right now. I think they're going to open because I think the planet is beginning its terminal phase of this extinction event, and the visitors are going to show up because this is the time. That's my thought.
Well, people have been through an awful lot before, too, so I don't know, but they never talked about UFOs. And the whole thing just seems so mysterious to me. I just don't know. You may be right.
Well, I'm hoping I'm not right, but I think I am right. I'm pretty sure I am. And as always, Irina, it has been a wonderfully fascinating conversation. And subscribers, do listen to her other shows and get Sacred Cartas. Go to irinascott.com and just get her books and spend some time with them, because the way to get people always ask me, how do I get in contact with the visitors? And you know, you can pay Stephen Greer $1,000 or whatever he charges and go out and flash laser pointers into the sky and do his little meditation, and you may very well have something show up. It does happen. But then you go home and you've been a UFO tourist. They will be interested in you, folks, if you are interested in them. And that's why you should engage with them, do the sensing exercise, read about it, think about it, talk about it. And you will become part of it over time, which I would think, just like I am and just like Irina is, like it or not, it's where we are. Irina, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. And again, our website is irinascott.com.
Well, thank you very much for everything you've been doing. You've been working a long time and hard and stood up for things and everything else, and thank you.
Well, yeah, they did choose a very stubborn cuss. I'm like a roach. You know, I'm stomped on and kicked around and stomped on, and then I come out from under the wainscoting on the other side of the room. So, yeah. Okay, Irina, onward and upward. We shall see, and hopefully the next time you're on the show, we'll both have even more to talk about.
Well, I hope so, and thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.